The U.S. defense industry is large, complex, and competitive. It is also lucrative for those companies able to navigate it successfully. The American Society of Military Comptrollers helps bridge the gap between the boardroom and the battlefield while supporting transformation in the defense sector. The Business of Defense podcast brings you inside the companies working to achieve this, directly from the business leaders, and to understand how they create value for their companies and their customers. For more information on ASMC, visit asmconline.org.
Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a Swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.
Episode 73, Legal Research and More, my conversation with law librarian Sarah Glossmeyer. My next guest is Sarah Glossmeyer. She's a lawyer, librarian, and technologist. Sarah has worked in and around the legal innovation space for over 10 years. She's held past positions at the American Bar Association, the Center of Computer-Assisted Legal Education, and the Running Court. Sarah was a research fellow at the Harvard Library Innovation Lab and an affiliate of the Berkman Center of Internet and Society. She's been named to the Fast Case 50, an ABA Legal Rebel, has been awarded a Lihatke, and was named to the 2017 ABA Legal Technology Research Center Top Women in Legal Tech list. Enjoy. Have you been enjoying the TechSavvyLawyer.page podcast? Consider giving us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcast feeds. Sarah, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, it's really great to be here.
I appreciate you being here. And to get things started, please tell me what your current tech setup is.
Okay. So for starters, I am a work from home person. So that this is all my at home tech setup.
Yep.
I have a ThinkPad laptop that I use. I can travel around with it. I actually don't ever take advantage of a work from home thing going down to my deck as much as I should, but I can do that. And I feel like my tech setup will be very much low. Anyone entry level could do this. I am very cheap personally. So my ThinkPad, I'm a Windows girl. I'm a world's biggest Microsoft apologist in the world.
Okay.
I did that as Zoom back in the day. So I run Windows because of my job and what I do generally for fun. I am a Excel and Microsoft Word is where I spend 90% of my working time.
Okay.
But I do for hardware, I'll start with the hardware. So I use a Logitech webcam that I got on Amazon, probably Logitech actually, that just says Logitech on me. But I only use that for the video just because I, especially in my previous job when I did a lot of Zoom calls, I don't do as much now, but just has a little bit crisper picture. That's those I got at Five Below. Okay, just microphone. I like wired headphones, a wired microphone. I think it's just because I'm old and I don't trust Bluetooth stuff. And I have too much hassle trying to always make sure it's connected.
Sarah, look at the screen, okay? Okay, you're not old. The guy across from you on the screen, he might be a little bit older.
I feel old compared to some people. But anyway, yeah, but I always like throw them in my bag and lose them. So that's why I don't ever invest money into actual good headphones. I have an LG monitor that I also got off of Amazon. It's wide enough that I can have two documents side by side. I actually never like using two monitors. I always get I lose my mouse. It hurts my neck. One giant monitor with windows slammed next to each other.
Is it a 4K, 5K?
Oh, no.
Fair enough. So I'm assuming you have like a 27-inch or a 32-inch monitor?
I think it's 32 inches.
Okay, cool.
I do have an iPhone and an iPad, which I also, because what I do, like in my jokingly will refer to as my thought leadership type of work that I do. I have a WordPress blog, very fond of open source technology. WordPress is open. I use a hosting service called Fat Cow, which I started using back in 2008 because a librarian friend recommended it to me. Probably should switch, but they keep giving me really cheap deals. And for the most part, I've gone viral recently, so it's my website has been able to stay up. But back in the old days, when I was a little bit more controversial, it did crash under pressure, but it's fine. I have a Substack blog, so again, very big on SaaS services, but I can do all that through my iPad or phone. I've written like papers on Google Docs using that as well. I'm a big fan of Google Docs as far as doing my private work, my non-professional or thought leadership work. And that's about it. I'm not really a techie as far as like hardware or gathering tools or liking toys. I'm always very much never buy the first thing. Like when something's first announced, I never jump on buying it. I wait a few months to make sure, especially something. But I'm very much a cheapskate, and I very much like to build or use stuff, either build it myself or find things that I can piece together. I think it's
Did you build any desktops yourself? Computer desktops?
No. That's the thing. I wish I could be a Linux person. Wish I could be. They seem like, I won't say they seem cool because they really don't seem cool. They're going through it every day, trying to make their product work. But I do stick with Windows. But as far as like, I wish I could be a little bit more homebrewy as far as some of the tech I use. But I just, sometimes you just have to go for what's easy and
pay
a little money, and it's worth it. Not fight against everything all the time.
Yeah, respectfully, I'm like the opposite. I'm not terribly cheap when it comes to my hardware and software. I've got a Mac Studio with an M1 Max chip, and I got the XDR Mac display, the 6K, $6,000 monitor. Oh, yeah. So yeah, I went the opposite direction. But I have to ask you, all right, you're a Windows gal. I think it was Windows girl was the phrase you used. I don't want to be accused of being sexist, but yet you have an iPad and an iPhone. So you have Mac, iOS, and Windows OS. How do those two worlds work for you? Do they work well, or are they constantly butting heads, or are you getting like, hey, I do it on Windows this way, I want to do it on my iPad, or vice versa?
For the most part, the one thing I do have a real problem with frequently is when I try to use Firefox on my iPad, just because for whatever reason, it crashes a lot when I do it. One of the few times I did jump on a bandwagon was when I got my first iPhone in whatever it was, 2009. It imprinted on me, and I just changed.
Okay.
And then with the iPad, it's because I can use iCloud and everything. I put download an app on one thing and it downloads on the other. Again, it's like with Linux. I wish I could be an Android phone user. I may have to try it again sometime, but probably 2015, I was due for a phone upgrade. So I tried
an
Android version, and I just didn't like it. And that's one of the things that's so, what I think it's funny about myself. I spent a lot of time in my professional life trying to help do change management, help people embrace new things, tell them how technology is not scary. But like in my own life, I just am in such a rut in some ways. And for the longest time, this is almost embarrassing to admit, but Firefox, I had so many plugins look basically the same way it did in 2009. Every time they updated the interface, I would just melt down. I mean, I do find things I like, and I just want to stick with it. And that's one of the things we talk about all the time in technology. It's like, what are your productivity gains by changing? And it doesn't make sense. And also just, I get into ruts. And I like how the iPad and iPhone interact with each other. I like the variety of apps. I like how easy it is just download stuff and like keep it updated. But with Windows, I started on Windows and I'd stick with it. And I like the way Firefox works. And even though I know everyone switched over to Chrome I just stick with Firefox still on the last standing on that.
Check out Brave. I've been using that mostly. And while it's built on a Chrome, I think, foundation, it seems to be a little bit faster and a little less clunky. You can still use the same extensions that you use on Chrome for Brave. But yeah, I haven't had many problems with it. I also use Safari, so I kind of use both interchangeably. Of course, you can't use Safari because you're on Windows.
Yeah.
But I think maybe one day you just got to like pull the trigger and get yourself a Mac desktop or laptop.
Yeah. Well, I think what the problem was, so I, in undergrad, was in anthropology and biology. Mm-hmm. It really was a double major, although I did take this one physics class, so biology is just a minor for me. But there was a lot of software we had to use for my biology courses that were only Mac available. And I went to Indiana University, and the Mac labs at that time were just not, it just, there's something about that. I think that was just that initial introduction to Macintosh computers. I just like, bad vibes. So, and there's something also like when I borrowed friends, like try to look something up on their Mac laptop. I don't know. It's just, again, muscle memory, like with the whole clicking with your thumb to do instead of a butt, you have to like push hard on the trackpad.
As they say, to each their own, you have to work with what works for you. Okay. I have both. Mostly I do my business for both the blog and the podcast and the firm on a Mac, but I do have a Surface Pro and a Samsung S22. The Pro I have mostly for the blog, but there's like one court where I have to use JavaScript in order to log into the court filing system. Meanwhile, everything else is like HTML5. And then of course the phone is specifically for the blog, but the way you feel about the Android is how I feel about it too. It's just not solid. It feels a little clunky and it's constantly updating, which.
Yeah. That's the thing I don't want to think about. Like something I'll hammer on, like I'll redesign my website 25 different times. Mm-hmm. Like my phone, I just want to plug it in and it does it. I don't have to think about it.
Exactly. But I tell you what, let's get into the questions. Question one, what are the top three tech tools utilized by larger law firms that solo and small law firms would be surprised are reasonably accessible to them?
So I can understand what it feels like to think like, oh, the big guys have these really fabulous tools. So I spent a lot of my career working in either academic settings or nonprofit settings, dealing a lot in the access to justice and the small and solo world. And then in 2021, I got a job at Raiden Court, which served primarily Amwell 50, Magic Circles, Seven Sisters, really big law firms and really large corporate departments. And I went there and I was like, wow, this is going to be like going to the land of Oz or something. Everything's going to be super neat. Like I'd been in larger law firms, mostly when they would host like one of my legal hackers had a group. Mm-hmm. And it seemed like everything was shiny and clean and they had Perrier in the fridge that was free for everyone to drink. This is going to be so great. And then I started talking to people that worked there in these large firms and then legal tech providers that were providing software for these companies. And I just realized, like, oh no, big law is as backward in some ways as they're not really doing anything different. They're still like basically using Word and Excel to track everything. So when I was thinking about this question, for me, it's not necessarily a product that you have to have. It's because like everyone has access to Word and Excel, basically.
Right.
But I broke it down more process oriented. And like the first thing was like organization. And so in your larger legal organizations and law firms. And that's one thing I actually just want to note. I will always probably say like legal organizations, just because I have a kind of a broader view. Like it's not just attorneys need to worry about this. It'll be the paralegals at your firms. It'll be legal ops in corporations. They're not always necessarily barred attorneys, but all like people in our neighborhood. So I tried to be inclusive and say legal organizations and legal professionals and legal services, just because that's the world I work in. That is lots of different kinds of allied professionals. But anyway, so in these larger organizations, the one thing they do really well is, well, not really well, but they try to do really well, is organization of their materials. So if you're a small and solo lawyer, this is like a really good thing you might want to think about is getting a file system, like an online, either a DMS, like an official one, like through a NetDocuments or an iManage or that sort of thing. But make sure your files and all your information is well organized. And also it can just be like in your machine's internal, but you should have like some sort of either a server or a cloud-based, depending on how what size you are, have your materials organized, set up a filing system, set up a taxonomy or some sort of tagging so you can find things easier.
Mm-hmm.
Just because, as we'll sure talk about eventually in this podcast, that AI is coming down the pipe and it's actually been here, but now it's becoming more accessible and becoming more of a thing that people need to realize. And before you get into any of that, you need to have well-organized material. So right now, like the one thing you want to think about is digitizing your files, having things accessible, having things just labeled right and in a way you can do that. And it's not even just like full files. Think about like templates of like documents that you create regularly.
Right.
Think about clauses if you are a transactional type of attorney, things that you can repiece and reuse, you know, get your content in order. But that's, you know, something that anyone can do. It doesn't matter what size of an organization you work for.
Well, are you really referring to, first of all, you have to have a naming convention. If you don't have a consistent naming convention, you're not going to find anything. And you talk about tagging, and you were mentioning some of these larger filing repositories on the cloud. And personally, I don't like having like my quote unquote permanent file on the cloud. I want my permanent file on my computer backed up on the cloud. But with a Mac, like we have tagging and there's a program called Hazel that'll work in the background. And based on naming conventions, based on the tags you put on it, I have a following process that goes into documents that have been scanned and that need to be OCR'd. And I look at the documents, I OCR them, they go into documents for review. I tag them, I make sure they're named correctly. Once that happens, it goes into another folder where it just automatically filters out into the appropriate client folder, if that makes any sense.
That's a great tool. I've never heard of that one, but.
And you could do, so that's a Mac only
program. That's why I haven't heard of it.
And I think Dropbox is getting that function or similar functions. To be honest, I don't play with Dropbox as much as I could. Although their data loss recovery, their file loss recovery is pretty good because sometimes I'll use my Time Machine. Sometimes I'll use Backblaze to back up my files and I'll get it there. Or I have an extra computer, like an old smaller computer that I use that has a complete backup of all my files. So, you know, there's a variety of places you can get to it, but like Dropbox and other competitors, I think are beginning to see how automation and workflows are helping their clients. And so they want to keep them contained within their product.
Oh, that makes sense. Yeah. I mean, that was because I love organizing things. It's literally what I do for fun. I just organized my closet this weekend. But I know a lot of people, I'm realizing a lot of people don't feel that way. And I mean, that one's one of the great uses for generative AI and LLM-backed AI is that it will do that organization for you. And I'm
right.
You know, there will be more and more commercial applications that you'll be able to just like throw a ton of unstructured data at, and it will help you figure out either the actual terms you should use, do the tagging, or actually sort out for you. But yeah, that's great. I mean, that's something that everyone should do more. And it's one of those things I have a hard time sometimes realizing how I think it's not necessarily how other people think, just like in previous work environments, having a shared file with other people and how some people don't like just create folders upon folders. They just throw everything into one massive folder. Yeah. You know, so if you're doing that, please don't do that or start figuring out ways, start getting through that mess. You'll thank yourself later.
So we have file organization and storage. What would be your next?
The other one is management of data. So I guess also to back up, I have like this mental image of how legal tech works.
Mm-hmm.
And because I think I came from a very generalist background, I got thrown into big law, realizing that transaction management is not wildly different than matter management that a corporate law office would do. So a lot of it's just like tracking what you do and like process mapping of like what is happening. So if you're, you know, obviously there's tools like Latera or other kind of transaction management or contract lifecycle management that you can, it's just like following through, like here's where this piece of paper is, who has to do what to it, and what have they done it yet? You're going to do like maybe some notifications. And you could do that, like it doesn't have to be a legal tech product. You know, you can use Trello or Coda. There are practice management tools that are aimed more at the small law world, like Clio that has that whole tracking and will ping you if you need stuff. So one of the things is, again, is that you can actually do this in Excel as well. That's what a lot of big law firms are doing. I mean, that's the one really horrifying thing to realize is like these multi-million dollar deals are basically being tracked by some like overworked associate in an Excel file, just checking off to make sure everyone signed the right thing.
Right.
So, and I think this, again, you figure out like what your processes are as far as like whatever you do regularly and like set up. I love Trello as far as just I can like move cart. You can, it has a little card system. You can move it through the process and know where every
The Kanban process.
Okay. Yeah. And it can be as much as like need to do, doing, done.
Right.
Or whatever your process is, like five steps that you have to do. Just so you figure out like where you are with that.
Right.
And again, like the third thing that anyone can do is, and it relates back to the first two, is like once you know your processes and you have maybe some templates or like you have yourself organized, figuring out what of this can I automate?
Right.
And then also, like, what also am I doing that can I maybe digitize? So even like using e-signatures or if you're someone, a client portal. And again, there are tools that have multi-functions within this. It'll have like matter intake and track matters with a client, but also will create a portal that your client can then come in and look and see what you're doing. It's just like what we're talking about with the other technology. Do you want something that you can really like, you have to really shape to make it the way you want? Or do you want something that you just send them a check and you plug it in and it works for you? So that's have to decide what your appetite is for the technology. But again, you know, so I guess the third one would be figuring out what you can automate or what you can digitize or otherwise save time doing that. It's one of those you know, might be 5 minutes of 5 minutes per matter, but that adds up after a while.
Oh, yeah. Oh, it's like pennies in a jar. After a while, yeah, it adds up. And it's funny in the sense that all these things that you're talking about, everything from file organization and storage, workflows and management and automation, that is stuff that is easily accessible to a small and mid-sized practitioner. From things like Clio to I use Daylight, which is a Mac-based CRM, the Smokeball. I don't know of anyone who is not, well, let me phrase this. Everyone has access to OCR, Optical Character Recognition Program, whether they're using it or they know how to use it.
Yep.
Or, I mean, I've been scanning and OCRing documents for the 17 years I've been in private practice. And it saves room when you can get rid of paper. You don't have to store it all. It's easy to search. And when you're looking for that keyword, say in a decision or in a deposition or whatever the case may be, it just makes life a lot easier. And then, of course, the automation, like I mentioned, I have a program called Hazel that works in the background. It does a lot of the automation that I think you're talking about for Freeman. I forgot the name of the product you were mentioning. I know you mentioned one for workflows and automation, or is there one that you maybe there was one you were thinking about?
Yeah. I did it for that. Yeah, for matter management or just management time, like Trello and Coda.
Right, but that's not big firm stuff.
Those are
right.
General tech, yeah.
Right.
But yeah, I think Clio was the one that's general matter management. But also, I mean, as far as like most thinking, also like even a virtual receptionist, something like that you can have instead of answering your phone all the time, especially if you're a smaller solo, have someone that you don't have to necessarily have like a real human full time, but like a distributed receptionist program that can either like do a chat on your website or the phone tree kind of thing. Things that you don't have to always do yourself in person. But there's ways you can outsource it to technology.
And I think programs like Clio, Daylight, and others, they have integrations with places like Ruby Receptionist, Smith.ai, and then, of course, like the calendaring systems like Calendly or what was the other one? Or Acuity. They have integrations that work well with those various CRMs for attorneys. And I'm presuming as well works well for larger law firms.
Yeah. Although I think, I'd be interested. I actually don't know this for how much of larger law firms are still employing humans. I mean, I don't think they are, but I don't know. Like, it would make sense if they didn't always, you know, that's something I should actually probably look into and track, just because, I mean, I know there was a kind of a trend, I guess you would say, about 10 years ago that a lot of the larger law firms were outsourcing their back room, like not like outsourcing them to like foreign countries, but they would just like, like they're a New York City law firm, but they would send their back room people to like Florida or Kansas City became a big hub of infrastructure just because it was like a Google Fiber kind of pilot.
Right.
Just moving into cheaper real estate. That's one of the things now with everyone working distributedly, working from home or working hybrid, like how they're managing that intake as far as, so I mean, I feel like if I'm paying someone $500 an hour, I want to call them and talk to a real person, but I don't know. That was interesting. We're in a very much state of flux right now for so many things.
I agree.
And that's one of those things I haven't really seen anyone cover. Not that it's not being covered, but I personally haven't seen it. But I'm now interested in looking up how they are handling their sort of receptionist kind of functions.
Well, people are realizing they don't have to go to downtown city to go to work. They would rather work from home and they save time on the commute. And that's a lot less stress, more time for themselves. And some employers think, oh, that's more time could work for me. On the other hand, too, the employers don't have to pay for brick and mortar. They don't have to pay for insurance. They have to worry about other incidentals related to that. And that adds up.
Pardon the interruption. I hope you're enjoying the TechSavvyLawyer.page podcast as much as I enjoy making them. Consider buying us a cup of coffee or two to help defray some of the production costs. Thanks and enjoy.
Let's move on to our second question. What are the top three ways ChatGPT is falling short for attorneys?
Okay. I don't think it's like revealing too much to say you sent me this question ahead. I've thought about it. I'm going to answer it in a different way in that I don't think ChatGPT is, and it is a really hard word to say. It doesn't roll off.
Say it 10 times fast.
It's often not even all ChatGPT. It's LLM based. That's the real moneymaker is LLM based thing. But ChatGPT itself, not necessarily failing attorneys because it wasn't designed for it. Attorneys are failing themselves by relying upon ChatGPT to do things that it wasn't designed to do. So it's not a search engine. It's not a case law researcher. It's not something really that could generate legal briefs or legal filings. So don't do that. Like, not right now, not with the public version that you can get on OpenAI, even if you're paying $20 for it. So I think, like, yeah, ChatGPT is not failing anyone. We are failing ourselves, or you are failing yourself if you are relying upon it to do things it was not designed to do. And then, so, like, and I think it's also, like, I understand everyone wants a magic bullet. Like, I was thinking about this on, like, every commercial break, there's a commercial, and a commercial for this weight loss pill. And I think, like, huh. Maybe that's the idea or the shot. And then you realize, oh, people who get the shot, their stomach stopped working, or like the pill is just like all these herbs and things that don't actually work. And so like magic bullets often don't work. But it's a real human instinct to really just want to say like, oh, there's this new technology and it's going to solve all our problems and it will do all my drafting for me and it'll be able to research and it has all access to all human knowledge. And then we just ask it a question that spits it out like a genie machine. And no, that's not the case at all. And there are people out there who are saying, like, it's going to replace lawyers. It's going to replace 50% of the legal functions in law firms. And I don't think that's the case at all. And it's, if you believe that, you're failing yourself again. Like, it's like you have to, like, learn who to trust. And again,
right.
And reading, this is mid-September, and I was reading something on Twitter today. It was a thing from Case Text, and they differed to me that it's been just about 6 months since they released CoCounsel.
Right.
And so that's the thing. It's so new, this concept of a AI legal assistant. So that's the thing. Like, don't feel bad if you don't know about it yet or don't fully understand everything there is to know about it yet. But it's time to start like figuring out like who to trust, who not to trust, or like any claim that seems like so too good to be true probably is. I definitely like, there's definitely people I know I listen to in this space. Nikki Shaver of Legal Tech Hub is one of them.
All right.
I think for like the negative view, Alex Smith and Jack Shepard, both are from iManage. And again, I think this is one of those areas like absolutely trust vendors in this space, because especially ones who are actual legal tech vendors, they are taking measured approaches. Like Pablo Arredondo and Jake Heller of Case Text, Damian Real of Belex, they're not trying to sell you anything. They're basically all in a, we're just trying to figure this out too, trying to figure out where the best places fits into legal functions. We're not here to say it will change the world, but it's not like going to replace everything.
Right.
So there's a new law librarian blog. I'm a law librarian by training. And so I believe very much in the knowledge and experience and vigor of law librarians to analyze legal tech. So there's a blog called AI Law Librarians that just launched. It's a bunch of academic law librarians who are tackling all the various issues. So like the hallucination issue, which is one that a lot of people think about. They had a really good explanation of that. I'm just like breaking down all the different things that you need to know about this. And I think it comes down to a lot of self-responsibility in this area. Like it's not, you have to understand like what your actual needs are for this tool, if any. Like you try to figure out like, what are my use cases? What is available right now in the LLM generative AI space that might need it, meet them? And then where can I match those two? And if, does it make financial sense? Does it make intellectual sense? Do I need to do it right now? Can I wait to 2024? Can I let the dust? Do I need to be a first adopter? Can I maybe be a second wave person? Yeah, it's just one of those, like, it's not ChatGPT's fault. It's not necessarily a reflection of the capabilities of the technology. It's not a reflection of the possibilities of the technology. Just some very well-publicized instances of people choosing the wrong tool for the wrong use case. So that's what I think about that.
Yep. All right. So hold on. I got two answers from you, I think.
Yeah.
The first being that it's not about a magic bullet, which I agree.
Right.
That people have to understand what their needs are and, to be blunt, how it fits in with the use of ChatGPT. How about a third?
So I think we'll just figure out who to listen to. There's definitely lists of people who are selling snake oil, okay, and who are just like not really like grasping reality. And that's one of those things. Like one of the people I have on my list is Casey Flaherty of LexFusion. He is all in on like generative AI.
Okay.
He's still very like not, I don't want to say cautious. He's still like realistic about its potential and what's uses. So I think it's one of those. You have to, this is one of those spaces, you're going to have to be a little proactive and find people who are like on this topic and who are like keeping up with the developments, which seems like every other week there's like a new release or a new product or a new potential issue. Having to find like, information sources. And it's going to be beyond the mainstream. And like, you can't just probably go to just Law 360 or any of the general main media, because it's going to be lots of different voices and just figuring out like the ones that you want to listen to. Because that's the thing, like right now, there's so very little, like even the one people who are like developing AI in-house, like right now, there's not a lot of test cases that you can actually really look at data and see how it actually performs. Because again, this is just a 6-month-old technology. I mean, it's older than that, but it really has hit availability to for us to start kicking the tires on for 6 months, like the way of thinking about it. Like right now, a lot of it is all theory. It's trying to just gather information. I guess that's finding, don't listen to PR, don't listen to people who are trying to like make these weird claims, like we're all going to be replaced by robot lawyers, or half of the law office is going to be replaced by someone or by technology.
The thing is, all your answers still comes down to personal responsibility.
Yeah.
And what constantly rises in my head is the attorney in the Southern District of New York who had ChatGPT write his brief for the court. And he didn't like check the citations. And, you know, the opposing counsel was like, hey, I can't find these sites. And then the judge's clerk's like, hey, we can't find these either. What's going on? And instead of doing his due diligence and actually looking up these cases, he said, hey, ChatGPT, are these legit citations? And of course, ChatGPT says, oh yeah, of course. Why would I make anything up? And then we learn about hallucinations and that it wasn't simply right. And whether it's ChatGPT or some other AI program that's helping you write your briefs, you still got to check your work. Same things you do with your clerks. You just don't blindly sign something off. You need to read it, make sure. And I think those quote unquote, those fictional cases that he had should have raised an eyebrow.
Yeah. I mean, it's very much like all of this, like and it's one of those like personal hobby horses, like everything to do with technology and legal technology. It all comes down to personal responsibility. Like there's, especially like education and training, but one of my big passions and getting people to learn about technology. Cause I came to technology quite late in my life and I'm still, even though I'm a technologist by passion, I'm not like a person who really like lives and breathes. Obviously, as I have like a great tech setup, I'm not someone that like would go to that Las Vegas consumer electronics. I'm not like someone like that. I use technology. The tool, it's like how cavemen use stone tools. Like it's what we use now. It's our new FlintNap tool. So but it's like one of those things, like I think people are just, and I'm still like mad, but just a few weeks ago, I saw a whole bunch of people on social media complaining about like, oh, we have to do this like 1 hour training on this tech tool. Ugh. And it's like, well, like, of course you do. Like, you just don't come out of law school and preserve yourself in amber and never like change anything. Like, you have to keep learning. I mean, professional development is part of our professional responsibility. And I know it's like hard because like there's been a couple waves in the past few years as far as like NFTs and the metaverse, where you're just like a blockchain, where you're like, oh, this is technology that's in search of a use and it doesn't seem like it's going to really take off. Absolutely valid. Now, it turns out none of those three actually did take off. Although I guess like the NFTs are creating a lot of criminal cases for people to kind of work on and maybe some other liability cases. But yeah, I mean, so it's hard to like figure out what is going to be the real thing and what's not. But I think like when like 6 months ago, ChatGPT co-counsel first came out, I was like not initially on board because so many of the use cases were initially talked about were things I like to do. Like I like to stare at a blank page of paper and start writing. Like I like to craft my own presentations and figure out like my thought process down that way. But then I started seeing things like how it helps with organization or how it does summarization. I'm like, oh, okay, now I can see use cases, not necessarily for me, but like summarizing large blocks of either depositional materials or large regulatory materials for either an attorney or a layperson. Like, okay, now I can see that's a really interesting use case. But like, you can wait a little bit to make sure something's going to be real or not. But at some point in time, you have to start not waiting to be spoon-fed and start doing a little proactive and understanding the landscape of the tools that you use, because your tools are like what you need to do to practice. You don't.
I was at the AI chatbot summit held in DC, and someone had said that only 10% of lawyers and attorneys are using ChatGPT and other AI like tools. And I will hope that number increases. But on the flip side, it's been said that ChatGPT and AI is not going to replace people, but people who don't use ChatGPT and AI are going to be replaced.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's like more like, and we kind of like the 10% number, like maybe not necessarily LLM-based generative AI, but it, like the idea of like only 10% using AI, I think it's higher than that. They just don't realize it. And that's how I eventually feel like this is going to, it's not going to be you're going to this product that just is a generative AI kind of tool. It'll be your same old Westlaw, and then you'll just have new little functions in there that you don't really realize. It'll happen quickly yet slowly that you just don't realize it's changed. And all of a sudden, a lot more of what you do will be a generative AI product or a LLM-based tool that I remember I saw it at both AAWL and IELTSCon this year. It was a tool from VLEX, an alarm, that it was a mixture. It was like the same thing that they've been doing in Docket Alarm for a while. And now they've added like extra functionality that's based on a generative AI product. And so it's all just blended in there. It's not like no flashy light that says, now you're using generative AI. It's all of a sudden like, oh, when you are like doing this research, little summaries of the stuff that you were citing comes up. And so it's all just seamlessly integrated into the workflow. And so that's probably going to be more how it happens, in my opinion, that it's just more, you're not like intentionally using generative AI is necessarily a product that you're already using.
Right.
Will all of a sudden add this functionality. So you're like, oh, this is nice. And you forget you never could do that. Like, we used to shepherdize and print. The idea that anyone ever did that is crazy. And the same thing's going to be like,
I did that. And trust me, I'm quite jealous of, I don't know if they teach that anymore, the book shepherdization.
I stopped teaching it in 2010 was the last year we decided to do it. And then.
Okay, go away. So, all right, let's move, before I get really angry here having to suffer through that so many years ago, let's move on to our last question. Question three, what are the top three directions do you see technology heading that attorneys should keep an eye on?
Okay, so obviously AI. Well, like, you can't get away from it. I wish some ways, like, I feel bad for talking about it so much, but it is the elephant in the room. Again, like, I really, truly believe, it took me a while to get here, but once I saw all the different functionalities that it had and saw like demos from various different vendors, how they are like integrated into current product stacks and not just like a whole brand new thing, it is going to be more and more there. And you need to start understanding a kind of the, you start figuring out various benefits and risks as far as just like what is the actual guarantees of this product. And again, I think if you are an attorney, which you probably are if you're listening to this, or someone who works in the legal world, if it's all you're using something that comes from like a VLEX or a NetDocs or an iManage or Thomson Reuters, you're probably going to be okay. Like, it's if you're rolling your own, like I tend to do, using products not necessarily developed for legal professionals, that's going to get a little dicey. And that's something you should not do unless you are super, super comfortable and super informed about what AI actually is, what it can do, where's your data going, all that kind of thing. And that kind of rolls into my next part is it's always been important, but I think more than ever, you need to start really learning about security issues, data protection, data privacy, even like actions such as redaction. I didn't need to rhyme, but that's one thing, like, I worked at Rain and Court. Like, I really started to learn a lot more about the security posture of software vendors in the cloud. And also, I guess it's one of those things that was shocking to me when I moved to Rain and Court and started talking to tech vendors who were servicing really large law firms. Again, you do have your 800-pound gorillas like Latera's, iManage's, and NetDocs who have lots of products, lots of employees, but a shocking number of legal tech companies are really pretty small, and they are using Azure and they're using AWS. And
all right,
but if me saying that makes you think so, that's your clue that if you are a small or solo practitioner who are like purchasing or looking for vendors in the cloud, you need to start understanding a little bit about data hosting, what that means, where's your data, who has it, who has access to your data, especially for client matters. So just the whole like security world.
Right. Great.
Getting yourself interested in this. I don't want to say take a CLE because that pretty anti-CLE industrial complex, 1 hour in a hotel lobby or hotel vault, but boardroom is not going to do much. But there are lots of great courses on LinkedIn Learning. They're a really great source for some security kind of basics. You can get a year subscription to LinkedIn Learning for about $250. And they have all sorts of courses, everything tech related. Big recommendation there. Beyond that, another thing to start thinking about is intellectual property. As far as, again, if you're like using, and it all kind of goes together, and like reading the terms of service of these tools, like when you acquire them, are they using your data to train their AIs?
Right.
What data did they use to train your AIs? what can you use in your own like creation of other things? You know, say you have a website for your law firm and you want to put some pictures of happy looking people that look like they've gotten some great legal services. Where are you getting those pictures? Do you have rights to use them? Who took them? All that sort of thing. Yeah. So just, I mean, IP touches everything and it's one of those things that you probably should have. So I guess like the second one would be security. You know, that was one of those things I really, when I was at Ravencourt, started to really grasp the idea, especially now with a lot more companies on the cloud. Obviously, like your bigger companies like NetDocuments and iManage and Thomson and Lexis, they are locked down. Like they're okay. Mm-hmm. But a shocking number of legal tech companies are just really like two guys and a developer. And they're not really huge. And they're just using AWS or Azure as their multi-tenant or single tenant. So it's things like, you know what, like if you're like hearing this, and you're like AWS, Azure, multi-tenant, single tenant, those words mean nothing to me. That's something you want to look like. Find out what those words mean and find out what it means for the data that you are uploading to the services. How long is your data held by them?
But what is wrong with companies like AWS or Azure? You're seeing a security nightmare, which
is just necessarily.
Finding
out like what their situation is there and hoping that they, again, like if they are on AWS or Azure, you're halfway there. Like that's pretty good.
Right. I'd be more concerned if they had a hard drive server in the back of their house or in their basement, and that's where all your private information is being stored.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, that's one of the things you want to find out: who's hosting your data? Who has access to that?
Right.
What does that mean? Like, and even it goes like as far as like some, how detailed you want to get in your kind of like security reviews, who has physical access to, like who has keys to that room, but also just a general understanding of where your data is. Like even like, again, depending on where you are listening to this, there's options that it might be hosted in the United States. It might be hosted in Canada. It might be hosted in the Europe. It might be hosted in the UK. That matters. It's for various reasons. So it's just like ease into it. One of the things, like I'm a big fan of LinkedIn Learning. They have courses for $250 a year. You can get a little bit up to speed on this. You don't necessarily have to get your like CIPP US licensor. Just start figuring these things out. Like you're going to have, like you can't necessarily just assume everything's going to be okay and that your stuff is protected. You need to understand like what's going on. And hopefully like if you are talking to a vendor, they will have like a data sheet for you that you can like, have these answers ready to go. And if they don't, red flag, just a quick thing. And so my third thing, like of just things to start like dipping your toes in and starting to understand, again, these are all like meta things, intellectual property. Again, especially now we're seeing with generative AI, but it affects everything you do, really. Even if you're a small and solo law firm and you have a website, you put some pictures on your website. What pictures can you use? Who owns those pictures?
Right.
What is the uses for that? Even if you want to get some fancy designs on mailers, like IP touches everything. But like with the generative AI context, when you read those terms of service, when you sign a contract, see who is looking at your data, not necessarily even confidential client materials, but that's super important. Are they using it to train their models? Just understand like, A, what do you own? What do they own? What can you use? Who's using your stuff? But again, like I'm on my personal level and I'm a really big advocate for open licensing where you still own it, but you make it clear that people could share it. So if you have something like a blog for your law firms, look at something called Creative Commons licensing. And that means everyone can just like remix it and reuse what you have. And it has all they credit to you if that's what you want. And you can also like put limits on it so it's not for commercial use. Just, I hated IP law. That's in law school. And then when I went to library school, everyone's like, oh, Sarah, you're a lawyer. You know all about this. I'm like, no, I don't. And I end up as an accident. I now spend a lot of time, not a lot of time, but I know enough about it to realize it's super important to know a little bit about it for everyone. So again, IP law, just start figuring out some basics as far as like ownership and reading the TOS of your services that you sign up for that, again, are hosting your information and knowledge.
Excellent, excellent. Well, Sarah, I appreciate you sharing all this with us today. Tell us, where can people find you?
Okay, so the easiest way to find me is to go to my website, sarahglassmeyer.com, and I have links to my various social media. Is so in flux right now. Who knows where I'm at? But I'm always on LinkedIn.
I'll
probably keep LinkedIn and I'll always have my website. But I do have a Substack, Sarah Glassmeyer.
What is Substack? This is new to me.
Substack is a federated newsletter service.
Okay.
And it's neat if you are interested in monetizing your content that you create, because you can, they make it very easy to do that. And there was a point in time that I was like, I need to have like maybe an alternative income stream. So I signed up for there. Because a lot of like journalist who can't, for whatever reason, their papers laid them off, or it just wasn't financially viable to work for magazines. They just do that, and you can have people subscribe. But also, I have free subscriptions because, like, right now, I'm not writing anything that anyone should ever pay for. But there is, it's basically, it takes my blog post and delivers it to your email inbox. And it just makes it easier for everyone involved. Like, that don't have to, like, make sure you've seen the link I've shared on every social media site. It just emails it to you, but they have some neat, like, I can recommend other Substacks within the network. Yeah, I just, it makes, it's very seamless, so nice. Whereas with my blog, you have to basically go to my website and see it. But yeah, I mean, I'm very easily Googleable.
Okay.
So basically, if you Google Sarah Glassmeyer in law,
wait, is Googleable, is that a word, or is that something that Sarah has coined now and we'll find in the dictionary? Be word of the year.
Yeah, it can always help. Yeah, I think it's an existing word, but I'll take credit for it.
Excellent. Well, I'll be sure to have all that in the show notes. And again, I want to thank you for being on. You have a great day.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining me on this episode of the TechSavvyLawyer.page podcast. Our next episode will be posted in about 2 weeks. If you have any ideas about a future episode, please contact me at michaeldj@thetechsavvylawyer.page. Have a great day and happy lawyering.